Blog Talk Radio.
Smoke News Radio Podcast. Welcome to Smoke News Radio 2020 with your host, Jason Brodsky.
Smoke News Radio, man. Here we go. Episode 53. We are taking it all the way. We are taking it all the good way, man. Let's have a good time. Smoke News Radio, episode 5-3. Let's get the levels going. Let's go. Today we talk about the international treaties of the world from the Global Cannabis Compliance, the BeckerKamenzie.com. Is the States Act the answer? Global cannabis compliance. As the movement towards legalization gains steam, international drug treaties are a big elephant in the room. Today, legalization advocates and politicians alike have focused on law at the local and national level. Little attention, however, has been paid to the multilateral treaties that arguably conflict with those laws. Most efforts to push a federal solution to the disparate local and national treatment of cannabis ignore the United States treaty obligations. This conflict must be addressed to ensure a smooth path forward. The international treaties are firmly anti-cannabis legalization. The 1961 United Nations Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, which the United States signed and pushed through, classifies cannabis as a Schedule 1 and Schedule 4 substance that requires parties to adopt special measures of control having regard to the dangerous properties of marijuana and to prevent the misuse of an illicit traffic in the leaves of the cannabis plant. Additionally, the 1988 Convention Against Illicit Traffic in Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances requires states to criminalize almost all forms of marijuana activity and to ensure that any discretionary legal powers under the domestic law relating to the prosecution of covered offenses are exercised to maximize the effectiveness of law enforcement measures in respect to those offenses, with due regard to the need to deter commission of such offenses. Interpreting these treaties, the United Nations has stated that the legalization of non-medical use of cannabis contravenes the international drug control treaties. Given the apparent conflict between the treaty requirements and legalization, commentators have suggested that the United Nations must renegotiate these instruments if it is to legalize and remain compliant with its international obligations. For example, in a 2014 article, Wells Bennett and John Walsh of the Brookings Institute argued that to avoid a damaging collision of international law and changing domestic international consensus on marijuana policy, the United States should seriously consider narrowly crafting treaty changes, and in other drug and treaty partners should begin now to discuss options for substantive alternatives that create space within international law for legalization conditional. While this recommendation has not been implemented, an international movement in the support of amending the treaties now appears to be developing. In 2019, the Director General of World Health Organization submitted to the Secretary General of the United Nations a recommendation that cannabis and cannabis resin be deleted from Schedule 4, not Schedule 1, of the 1961 Convention. Additionally, the Chief Executive's Board of the United Nations issued a statement of commitment to promote alternatives to conviction and punishment in appropriate cases, including the decriminalization of drug possession for personal use, and to promote the principle of proportionality to address prison overcrowding. Nevertheless, amending three international treaties will not be easy and may take much longer than Congress is willing to wait to change federal law. For those seeking legalization, the Strengthening the 10th Amendment through Entrusting States Act, the STATES Act, which was reintroduced by Senators Warren and Gardner on April 4th, may provide a solution. There are at least three reasons for this. First, the States Act would leave cannabis in Schedule 1 while prohibiting federal law enforcement from prosecuting individuals and entities in compliance with state law and a new set of federal guidelines. Thus, it would arguably keep the United States in compliance with its obligations to criminalize cannabis. Second, as noted above, the treaties require states, in the words of the 1988 convention, to exercise their discretionary legal powers to maximize the effectiveness of law enforcement measures in respect of covered offenses. As the UNCEB noted in its January statement, the conventions allow for sufficient flexibility for countries to design and implement national drug policies according to their priorities and needs. Shifting enforcement resources from state-compliant behavior to cannabis trafficking that involves sales to children, organized crime, and diversion to prohibition sales would allow the government to combat more effectively the kind of aggravated drug trafficking that the treaties were designed to eradicate. Such a legislative change is therefore arguably precisely the kind of discretionary decision that the treaties require states participate make. Third, the treaties also provide more flexibility to states based on their constitutional structures and make repeated reference to national constitutional limitations. For example, Article 36 of the 1961 Convention, which contains the main provisions of criminalization, begins with the words, "Subject to its constitutional limitations, each party shall..." Given that the States Act is based explicitly on the United States constitutional structure and the balance it attempts to strike between the federal and state power, it is arguably consistent with the treaty's deference for national constitutional structures. Whether legalization is desirable from a policy perspective is a subject for another day. But if the federal government decides to move in this direction, it will have to reconcile the change in law with the United States international treaty obligations. The States Act may be one way to square this circle. The author, Tom Firestone, is a co-chair of the firm's North American Government Enforcement Practice and member of the firm's Global Compliance Investigation Steering Committee. He represents clients involved in anti-corruption, U.S. foreign corruption practices, international investigations, transactional due diligence, and is also a member of the firm's Cannabis Review Committee and has advised clients on compliance issues related to cannabis. Thank you, guys. You're listening to Smoke News Radio. Take a sip first. Here. I'm going to see how this sounds. There we go. Back on that side. When I reach it, each way, like Instagram can or might not have the music. Right now, it does not have the music. Hopefully. Not hopefully, but just like, there's a blog talk. We've got the beats on the blog talk. continue on. Smoke News Radio from the hempindustrydaily.com. United Nations body sees challenges for adding CBD footnote to international narcotics treaty. Written by Monica Raymonds. Read to you by Jason Brodsky on Smoke News Radio. The World Health Organization's proposal to exempt plant-derived CBD extracts and tinctures with less than 2% THC from international control under the United Nations Narcotics Convention could be difficult to enforce. The United Nations monitoring body has said the International Narcotics Body said authorities in some countries may lack the lab technology or manpower to evaluate the cannabinoid profile of CBD preparations, something that would be necessary to ensure compliance with the exemption. The World Health Organization has made several recommendations early last year for the changing how cannabis is scheduled in the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, 1961, and the Convention on Psychotropic Substances of 1971. With the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs planning to move forward with a vote on the recommendations this December, the Vienna-based INCB conducted an analysis on how the six recommendations could affect United Nations member countries. In the INCB is the independent and quasi-judicial monitoring body for implementing the United Nations Narcotics Conventions. Its analysis was provided to member states before the first in a series of pre-vote UN meetings in April. A copy was obtained by Hemp Industry Daily on the condition that the document not be published. Most of the cannabis scheduling recommendations would have little impact on international drug controls on tightened requirements. Of the six proposed scheduling changes, two are most relevant for products containing plant-derived cannabinol. CBD is not specifically listed in the international drug control treaties, but is covered by the 1961 convention, both as preparation and as an extract or tincture of cannabis. Recommendation 5.4 suggests that extracts and tinctures category be deleted from Schedule 1 of the 1961 Convention to reduce repetition, while Recommendation 5.5 suggests a footnote be added to the cannabis entry in the 1961 treaty to clarify that preparations containing predominantly CBD and up to 0.2% THC are not under international control. The latter recommendation is based on the WHO's conclusion that CBD extracts do not carry risk of addiction or abuse that other substances named in the treaties do. Medical and forensic services in some member states may not have the technology or human resources to ensure compliance with some of the recommendations. National legislation recommendations for the cultivation of cannabis would need to be reviewed and changed in order to differentiate cultivation from extraction of CBD and or Delta 9 tetrahydrocannabinol for the industrial purposes, as described in the 1961 convention, the INCB added. The World Health Organization recommends have been touted as a positive step towards the easing of the international control of cannabis, which would be a positive development for the medical marijuana and hemp industries. The main issue to consider relates to its practical implementation at the national level, because in most cases, chemical analysis down to the threshold indicated in the recommendation may not be possible. The agency identified lack of access to appropriate identification techniques for the required level of accuracy and even where feasible. The INCB mentions it might not be considered to be a good use of resources. The INCB also raised concerns over cannabis cultivated for the extraction of CBD. The reason the board considers CBD would need to be monitored because it does not meet the definition of industrial purposes. The INCB president, Cornelius P. Josiah, has said that if the cultivation of cannabis is for the production of the flowering top, then it should be considered under control regardless of the THC or CBD content. Some countries, such as France and the United Kingdom, follow the restrictive interpretation that do not allow hemp growers to use the flower to extract CBD. This is written by Monica Rimmett. On to the next one on Smoke News Radio from MJ Biz Daily. Another look at the United Nations Commissions, written by Alfredo Pasquale. Not all World Health Organization cannabis recommendations would loosen international control. Read to you by Jason Braskin, Smoke News Radio. It's Rat. United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs holds a virtual meeting to discuss World Health Organization recommendations on cannabis. An analysis by the United Nations monitoring body concludes that most of the World Health Organization's cannabis scheduling recommendations would either have little impact on international drug controls or actually tighten requirements. The analysis conducted by Vienna-based International Narcotics Control Board, the INCB, was provided to member states shortly before the start of the first in a series of United Nations meetings. A copy was obtained by the Marijuana Business Daily. The World Health Organization recommendations are often celebrated as a positive step towards the easing of the international control of cannabis, which would be a positive development for the industry. Particularly, one recommendation would be a big symbolic win because it would implicitly acknowledge the medical value of cannabis at the highest international level. But regarding practical implications in the level of international control, the INCB document found that, if adopted, two recommendations would imply no meaningful change. To others would mean more control for pure THC. To others would imply less control for certain pharmaceutical preparations containing THC and for some CBD products. But the INCB also said clearer definitions are needed. The board did not position itself in favor or against any of the WHO's recommendations. The INCB is currently participating in Commission of Narcotic Drug CND meetings aimed at preparing member states of the commission for a December vote. The first meeting started June 24th in a virtual format. The key takeaways in the document, the INCB wrote that adopting some of the recommendations would standardize the control requirements applicable, making it easier for competent national authorities to monitor and report information to the INCB. The board emphasizes the importance of more accurate definitions when it comes to certain recommendations, particularly Article 5.6. to ensure a shared understanding among member states. The INCB noted that increased control measures could be a burden for some nations if recommendations 5.2 and 5.3 are adopted. Technical challenges could hinder the implementation. Recommendations 5.5, 5.6 would require member states to identify and control the precise composition of the preparations, according to the board. If recommendation 5.5, which is focused on CBD, is adopted, the national legalization would be required to differentiate cultivation from extraction of CBD or Delta-9 THC and for industrial purposes, as described in the 1961 convention. The INCB considers only fiber and seed to be industrial purposes. The board noted current inconsistencies that some countries don't report the cultivation of cannabis plants with low THC and the manufacture of CBD products because CBD isn't explicitly scheduled. And recommendation 5.1, cannabis is currently included in Schedule 1 and Schedule 4 of the 1961 treaty. The WHO recommends its deletion from Schedule 4, keeping it in Schedule 1. However, the INCB found that if the recommendation is adopted, control measures at the international level will not change. Neither would the periodic reporting requirements which member states must comply. THC was not well known when the 1961 convention was drafted, but was included in the 1971 Convention on Psychotropic Substances. The World Health Organization recommended transferring THC from the 1971 treaty to the Schedule 1 of the 1961 treaty. The rationale behind the recommendation is simply the reporting expectation from the member states and streamlined international control. According to the INCB, these recommendations would result in a number of additional control measures. 5.5, extracts and tinctures of cannabis being deleted from category Schedule 1. Extracts and tinctures don't need to be listed as these products are also considered preparations. The presence of extracts and tinctures of cannabis in Schedule 1 could be considered a repetition that Recommendation 5.8 aiming to correct. In other words, they don't want alcohol involved. In other words, it appears that INCB position is that adoption of the recommendation would not have a meaningful practical implication in terms of control. If this recommendation is adopted, a footnote would be added to the cannabis entry in Schedule 1 of the 1961 treaty to clarify that preparations containing predominantly CBD and up to 0.2 THC are not under international control. The rationale for this World Health Organization recommendation, CBD is not liable to the same level of abuse of substances, including in the treaties. The INCB found that while CBD is not specifically listed in the international drug control treaties, CBD is produced from an extract of cannabis is included in the 1961 convention. The main issue to consider relates to its practical implementation at the national level. All right. It's okay. Pretty much the same thing, same guy. Next one. Let's go to South Africa. CannabisIndustryJournal.com, written by Marguerite Arnold. 6 to 7 minutes. You know, these articles get kind of long, so just like, you know, you get every article is a pyramid format. Everything you need to know is in the first freaking paragraph. The first line, the first word. Okay. The South African government has taken a leap into the future. Namely, it has begun to regulate hemp in line with Europe and attempted to remove THC, part of the equation, from a domestic list of plants and drugs with no medical use. And that's the pyramid. There's the whole article. There's all the 7-8 minutes. So now, what are the details to fill it in? Okay. The notice was signed by South African Minister of Health, Zyla Mlisse, published a week after a domestic moratorium of CBD expired. The moratorium permitted the sale of some of the kinds of CBD products. This is an intriguing new development, although it will be undoubtedly cause headaches for the burgeoning industry in the region. On the CBD front, South Africa's new hemp guidelines, namely for the amount of THC allowed in legit hemp crops that are also regulated, are that plants contain no more than 0.2 THC. This makes the guidelines absolutely in line with what is generally developing across the United Nations, EU. European Union, I guess. And even more intriguingly, below federal guidelines for most United States domestic hemp crops, which are at 0.3 at federal level, and only differ in a few states' cases where the amount is lower by state law. However, there is also a unique twist to all of this. The South African government has now created a two-pronged regulatory schema just for CBD. The default approach to the cannabinoid is that it is, in fact, medication scheduled under South African International Global Drug Guidelines as Schedule 4 drug. The structure of CBD cannabinol is one of 400 active compounds found in cannabis. The other designation is reserved for CBD packaged in sizes of 600 milligrams or less and is limited by instructions to more than 20 milligrams a day. This kind of CBD, despite the dubious understanding of cannabinoid science, will henceforth be labeled a supplement and on Schedule 0, 600 milligrams or less. However, do not be fooled. This is not a descheduling. This actually means that all CBD has been classified as a medical substance, except in packets that are under a certain size, with portion suggestions on the outside of the wrapper or package. This is hardly scientific. However, what is more burdensome is that any CBD cultivator in South Africa must also GMP or international medically be certified, even if bound for the supplement market by definition. In other words, it'll make the cost of production for the supplement, commercial food and cosmetic, part of the equation, as expensive as pharmaceutical production. While from the purest point of view, having ultra-clean cannabis in any product at the level of pharmaceutical standards is a wonderful idea, but this gets ridiculous when it comes to reality and will ultimately never stand. This development is also undeniably inconvenient, at minimum for anyone who has envisioned outdoor hempires, which most of the cannabis grown in South Africa is. The only people who have the money to build indoor grows starting with GMP-certified greenhouses are, for the most part, white people, foreigners, or those who own property and have access to external international equity. And the sins of apartheid, in other words, are being written language on entire cannabis industry to present in South Africa, and CBD is contained right in the middle of the mix. On the THC front, there are several interesting aspects to this. The first is that THC has been removed from the South African Schedule 7, which is roughly equivalent to the International Schedule 1 that cannabis also resides in until the World Health Organization, or or re or deschedule the same. However, this also means that all CBD as well as THC must be produced by those with pharmaceutical-grade facilities. This, of course, includes more than just indoor temperature-controlled greenhouses. It also includes a complex supply chain that is European, Western-centric, starting with the requirement to access a rather large amount of capital to construct the same global realignment or stopgap measure. This new regulation, in other words, specifically leaves the vast majority of what has been already been seeded or was most likely to be in the hands of a few Canadian and other companies who have been moving in this direction for the last several years. It also implies, intriguingly, that the intra-African cannabis market is low priority at present for those writing the health rules. And that also means that eyes are being set more on creating an export market than for treating South African citizens. It is not an unusual move, rather tragically so far, and almost certainly one that will be challenged, and in several directions, both by events, but also by firms caught in the mix. For starters, the South African cannabis market effectively controls the Lesotho cannabis regulatory scheme, namely all exports from Lesotho, which has seen quite a lot of cannabis investment over the last several years. All such crops must be labeled per South African guidelines if they literally can hit a port to be exported. The vast majority of these grows, even with relatively decent foreign backing, are also outside and, of course, as a result, ineligible for GMP certification. Of course, given the fact that the United Nations is likely to clarify both the status of THC and CBD by the end of the year, this current situation in South Africa is also fairly clearly intended to be a stopgap regulatory measure to last until at least this time. Where it may go after this is anyone's guess. This measure, however, is also clearly being made to protect those who have invested in GMP-grade facilities, as opposed to those who have been clearly angling for reform on the CBD front. Starting with the beer market. Stay tuned. Investments ahead. All right. Okay, how are we doing? 32s. Okay, this is from Reason.com. I think it's the shorter of the two of them.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. This is the formerly secret memo explains the DEA's long delay in approving new producers of marijuana for research. Written by Jacob Sullum. Since the Drug Enforcement Administration was founded in 1973, it has allowed only one entity to produce marijuana for research, the National Center for Natural Products Research at the University of Mississippi, which grows cannabis under a contract with the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the NIDA, according to a newly disclosed 2018 memo. The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, thinks that 47-year-old arrangement has always been illegal. The OLC does not think this marijuana monopoly is too restrictive. It thinks the arrangement is not restrictive enough. The memo, which says an international treaty requires tighter controls on the production and distribution of marijuana, explains why the DEA has been slow on following through on its 2016 commitment to allow alternatives to the National Institute on Drug Abuse to supply. The DEA agreed to disclose a memo yesterday as part of the settlement agreement with the Arizona Scottsdale Research Institute, which is investigating marijuana's potential as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. For decades, marijuana researchers have complained about the quality and the variety of the marijuana provided by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is notably inferior to the offerings of state-licensed dispensaries on both counts. President Sue Sisley found that marijuana she was compelled to use for her federally approved PTSD study was powdery mishmash of stems, sticks, and leaves. Laboratory tests detected relatively high levels of mold, which the researchers ultimately decided not to pose a threat to the subjects. The tests also found that the THC and CBD concentrations were not quite what the NIDA had promised, which already was not quite what researchers had wanted. The National Institute on Drug Abuse monopoly also creates an insurmountable obstacle for anyone planning to market cannabis as a medicine, since marijuana supplies cannot be used for commercial processes. The Food and Drug Administration, meanwhile, requires the clinical studies be conducted with the same product that would be used by patients if the drug is approved. The solution to these problems seems obvious. Instead of requiring researchers to use inferior marijuana from a government-created monopoly, allowing competing producers to supply what scientists actually want, while the DEA has long permitted more than one organization to produce other Schedule I substances for research, marijuana was always an exception. Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, together with the University of Massachusetts horticulturalist Lyle Crocker, began trying to break the National Institute on Drug Abuse's monopoly in 2001, and it obtained a favorable ruling from an administrative law judge in 2007. But Michael Leonhardt, then the DEA's acting administrator, overrode that decision in 2009, and Crocker could not persuade federal courts to intervene. All that seemed to change in August 2016 when the DEA announced it would begin accepting applications from additional marijuana suppliers. Three dozen would-be producers sought the DEA's approval, but their applications seemed to go nowhere. Notwithstanding multiple bipartisan inquiries from members of Congress on a 2019 order by a federal appeals court demanding that the DEA explain itself, press reports suggested that the DEA had encountered resistance from the new Attorney General Jeff Sessions, an old-fashioned drug warrior who was a senator had famously declared that good people don't smoke marijuana. In 2018, Sessions testified the DEA and the Department of Justice were moving forward with the licensing process, but alluded to an international treaty that required revision of the previous proposal. 2 months later, the OLC issued its memo, in which the Deputy Assistant Attorney General Henry Whitaker fleshes out what Sessions had in mind. Breaking with nearly half a century of policy under administrations of both parties, Whitaker concludes that the federal government's handling of research marijuana is inconsistent with the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs of 1961, an international treaty that Senate approved in 1967. 3 years later, Congress incorporated the Single Convention's requirements in the parts of the Controlled Substance Act. The Single Convention allows the cultivation of marijuana for scientific or medical purposes, but requires that it be done in accordance with the same restrictions that apply to opium poppies. Among other things, Those rules require that a single government agency oversee cultivation, take physical possession of such crops as soon as possible, but no later than 4 months after the end of harvest. The single convention also requires the agency have exclusive right to importing, exporting, wholesale trading, and maintaining stocks other than those held by the manufacturers of medical products. Whitaker concludes that the longest DEA-NIDA arraignment with the University of Mississippi's marijuana growers does not meet those requirements. First, the program involves more than one federal agency, while the DEA, a division of the Justice Department, licensed the University of Mississippi's marijuana growers, NIDA, part of the Department of Health and Human Services, oversees production. Second, the DEA never takes physical possession of the crops, which the National Center for Natural Products Research ships directly to scientists approved by the NIDA. Third, the DEA does not have exclusive rights when it comes to wholesale trading and maintaining stocks, which are handled by the center under the NIDA supervision. Whitaker concedes that the International Narcotics Board control is supposed to monitor compliance with the single convention, which was never objected to the United States marijuana program or to similar arrangements in other countries. But he says the treaty requirements, which are mandatory under the Controlled Substances Act, clearly rule out the current approach. The OLC's position clarifies the motivation for the little-noticed marijuana regulation that the DEA published on March 23rd. According to the summary on a proposed rule, there we go. Somewhere on the screen is the word that I'm reading. There you go. The DEA noted that the Justice Department undertook a review of the CSA, Controlled Substances Act, including the provisions requiring consistency with obligations under international treaties, such as the Single Convention, and determined that certain changes to its 2016 policy were needed. Under the provision proposed rule, all registered manufacturers who cultivate cannabis shall deliver their total crops to the DEA. It adds that the DEA may accept delivery and maintain possession of such crops at the registered location of the registered manufacturer authorized to cultivate cannabis, consistent with the maintenance of the effective controls against diversion. In other words, the DEA is still reading physical possession as requiring something short of what that phase seems to apply. If the DEA determines that no suitable location exists at the registered location of the registered manufacturer that authorized the cultivate cannabis, the rule says, then the DEA shall designate a location for the authorized grower to deliver the crop. Similarly, the DEA plans to assert its exclusive right over importing, exporting, wholesale trading, and maintaining stocks, which shall not extend to medical cannabis or cannabis preparations, or authorizing the performance of such activities by appropriately registered persons. The transactions must have DEA's express written authorization. The upshot is that the DEA plans to insert itself as a middleman in the distribution of marijuana for research, although it's not clear how much more erroneous the arrangement will be than the current DEA-NIDA system. In a letter she sent members of Congress yesterday, Ceres consists of a highly irregular administrative process based on a secret reinterpretation of an international treaty from 1961. She notes that Congress could streamline production and distribution of research marijuana, though new legalization. But she also argues that the DEA could use a different provision of the Controlled Substance Act to achieve a similar result. That provision says the Attorney General may, by regulation, waive the requirement for registration of certain manufacturers, distributors, and dispensers if it finds consistent with public health and safety. Unlike the part of the law that the OLC has interpreted, Sisley notes that provision does not mention international treaty obligations. Given the undistributed urgency, the need for this research, she argues, waiving certain registration requirements to allow already licensed Schedule I researchers obtaining marijuana from other sources would be consistent with the public health and safety. Sisley suggests the DEA could, for example, exempt licensed Schedule I marijuana researchers from having to obtain a separate registration to manufacture marijuana, provided those researchers agree not to distribute any marijuana they manufacture. Alternatively, she says, it could permit licensed Schedule I marijuana researchers to obtain marijuana from state legal dispensaries. One way or the other, it looks like the DEA is finally moving forward with approval of alternative marijuana suppliers. But given decades of intercessions followed by years of foot dragging, one could be forgiven for being skeptical. Smoke News Radio. Oh, I got so many cables under my feet. Not too many, but still a few of them. You just gotta weave your legs and write. All right. Smoke News Radio. Jason Brodsky on the mic. All right. From CDC.ca, cannabis policy makes the international rebel on drug treaties. From the CBC News. From the CBC News. Evan Dyer. Canada's legalization of recreational cannabis use was not and still hasn't been accepted as legitimate by the United Nations, an international body that oversees three United Nations drug treaties that Canada signed. While many Canadians have focused on supply problems and overly optimistic business projections that have marred Ottawa's marijuana legalization project, it also left behind some international loose ends that still haven't been tied up. Not all countries have accepted Canada's right to forge a new path on cannabis law. At the ending of Canada's 95-year ban on cannabis appears to have accelerated the demise of a worldwide consensus, a treaty regimen that for decades underpinned the global war on drugs. A year after legalization, Canada remains in flagrant violation of United Nations drug treaties that it signed, an uncomfortable situation for a country that likes to see itself as a stickler for international laws and treaties. The government of Canada has contributed to weakening the international legal drug control framework and undermining the rules-based international order, says the United Nations International Narcotics Control Board. In December, the INCB president, Cornelius Don Jerchery, reminded nations that the United Nations has repeatedly and publicly spoken out that these legalization laws are in violation of the obligations under the conventions. Bolivian maneuvers. heavily redacted memo that appears to have been signed by Ian Shugart as Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs just a month before cannabis became legal, discusses withdrawing cannabis's objection to treaty actions by Bolivar under the Single Conventions of Narcotics Drugs in 1961 in advance of the entry into force of the Cannabis Act. When Bolivar tried to When Bolivar tried to join the convention in the 1980s, it faced a dilemma. There were the boom days of the cocaine trade, and the coca plantations of South America were seen as the source of the scourge. But the people of the Andean nation had been chewing coca leaves for centuries, generations. The Bolivians So Bolivia negotiated a 25-year exemption for coca leaf, a woman. As the 25-year deadline loomed, the government of former coca farmer Evo Morales tries to persuade the countries to change the treaty. Other signatories weren't willing to change the convention. Bolivians weren't willing to ban coca leaf, so in 2012, they decided on a bold stroke. Bolivia would crash out of the three international drug treaties and then apply to re-enter with its own permanent exemption for coca leaf, now enshrined in a new Bolivian constitution as part of the nation's indigenous heritage. While Canada says no, the move was opposed by the United States, already deeply suspicious of the leftist president, who had banned the DEA from his country 4 years earlier. But objections also came from some of the world's most progressive countries on drug policy, such as Portugal and the Netherlands, who saw it as a bad faith way to get around the treaty would set a dangerous precedent. Canada was among a group of 18 parties at the convention that did not support Bolivia's proposal at the time. But Bolivar had studied the United Nations rules carefully and knew its opponents would be unlikely to get one-third of a treaty members to raise a protest. Without that, the objections would not stand. And by 2013, Bolivar was back in the treaties, now with a permanent exemption for coca leaf. Today, Canada finds itself in much the same position Bolivar did in 2012, openly violating the treaties it signed. Its Bolivarian objection now looks like hypocrisy. In the end, said Puebe, Ottawa never formally withdrew its objection. Bolivar was successful in reascending with the reservation to certain obligations to permit traditional coca leaf practices in its territory. With that step by Bolivar, no further action has been required by state parties with respect to the matter. And yet, as redacted memo shows, Canada was still debating at the highest levels whether to formally withdraw that objection years after Bolivar's action. John Walsh of the Washington Office on Latin America testified as an expert before the Senate committee that examined the international effect on Canada's legalization plan. Quote, they're interested in finding a solution that reconciles their domestic policy changes, from which they're not retreating with their international treaty obligations. He said, getting to the point is not the easy part. As Russians lead the charge, Walsh said Canada is facing steady pressure from signatories to the drug treaties, particularly Russia. For Russia, it's tantalizing opportunity not just to bash Canada, but to call the West on its hypocrisy on the rules-based international order and sow divisions among the West, which it sees as antagonistic and oppressive of its interests. Walsh told the CBC News. I think they take some glee in being able to point to Canada and say, the West seeks to impose this rules-based order on us, but when it comes to following their own obligations, their a la carte, which is contrary to what international law requires. Russia and Japan led the objections earlier this year when Canada and Uruguay joined a World Health Organization-supported initiative to downgrade cannabis from its Schedule 4 classification. Because the United States has sidelined itself on this issue, Russia sees itself as stepping into the void and has been able to make a rally at a lot of like-minded prohibitionist countries in Africa and Asia, Walsh has said. Now they're opening up Pandora's box. Russia's objections may have something to do with scoring points, but they also reflect the country's view very different approach to drug policy. Quotes, the new drug policy of the Ottawa contradicts the 1961 Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, quoted, said in a statement from the Russian embassy. Under that convention, the statement said the Canadian side is obliged to perform in good faith its international legal obligation and has no right to invoke its internal legislation as a justification for its failure to perform the international treaty. Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland has acknowledged that the new cannabis law does selectively violate the treaties, although Brebe said the approach is consistent with the overarching goals of the United Nations drug conventions. And the Russians aren't buying the agreement. They're not taking the agreement. They're not buying the argument. The decision adopted by Canada, in fact, opens, quote, Pandora's box by introducing a selective approach towards the implementation of the United Nations Drug Control Conventions, quote, Holeske said. Quotes, there exists real danger that some other countries may follow the example set by Canada, which would lead to the erosion and even dismantling of the whole international legal foundation of our fight against narcotic drugs. That fear seems to be coming true, at least in the Western Hemisphere, where courts and governments are chirping away at the architecture of prohibition. Someone has got to go first, Uruguay's president Jose Mujica said in 2013 when his country led the way to full legalizing marijuana. In the United States, marijuana is now fully legal in 11 states and fully illegal in only 10, with medical exemptions or decriminalization states in the rest. Nice. You guys are listening to Smoke News Radio, episode 53. Chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga
for some little run out. Enjoy the night. Jason Brodsky, your host. Somehow it goes fast, somehow it goes fast. Do, 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 do. Everything's in it. That's what it's all about. It's all about lining it up just perfectly. Everything's perfect. All right, thank you very much. Have a wonderful night, everyone. Be safe out there. Stay healthy.
A billion people died on the news tonight, but not so many cried at the devil's side. Well, Mama said, it's just make-believe. You can't believe everything you see, so baby, close your eyes. the lullabies on the news tonight. Who's the one to decide that it would be